CIE 75 Years on the Go is supported by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland Sound and Vision Scheme through the Television Licence Fee. Welcome to the third and last part in our 75 Years on the Go series. Buses, and particularly trams, evoke nostalgia in people. So we're going to look at the development of road transport in Ireland, courtesy of Bernard Byrne.
The background to transport in Dublin goes back a couple of hundred years, specifically to public transport. I think the development of the tramway system in Dublin from around the early 1870s was a significant development in regard to the growth of the city and its suburbs. And the original tramways, the vehicles were hauled by horses. And of course, I think most people recognise that the open top and open fronts and open everywhere were really not very comfortable for the people of the time, but nevertheless was a tremendous innovation insofar as transport was concerned. And gradually lines developed all over Dublin and its suburbs. The Dublin United Tramways Company came into existence in 1896. And around this time also, electric trams started to appear on the streets of Dublin. In fact, Dublin had quite a network in the early stages of electric tram lines. And I understand that it was one of the earliest cities in the world to have electric trams, and they were proven quite successful with the travelling public, of course, and with the companies themselves. So gradually the horses were dispensed with, and the tram lines were all electrified. And of course, as we come into the early 1900s, I think most people are familiar now with that background of history of the 1913 lockout, when William Martin Murphy, who really ran the Dublin United Tramways Company, decided that he was not having the transport union representing the staff in the tramways, and the great lockout of 1913 will be forever associated with William Martin Murphy and the Dublin United Tramways Company, and what transpired after that, which in fact was a very sad reflection on the employment outlook as such in Dublin and employers' attitude to trade unions. But that's another day's story. The lines continued to develop in the early 1900s and on into the 1920s and 30s. But the change came about insofar as the impact on trams by motor cars in Dublin. And that would have taken place in the late 1920s. I think big changes came after the First World War, particularly with transport and motorised transport, because it was getting a firmer grip overall in society, both in the case of public transport and the haulage of freight also. But the 1930s, I think, would have also been the peak of tram traffic. I have seen a figure quoted of somewhere in the region of 70 million passengers a year going by tram in the Dublin area. And that, when you look back, was a colossal figure. The trams were all double-deckers. There may have been one line in Dublin, I think, down through Bath Avenue in Sandymount that had single-decker trams because of the low-lying railway bridges. But nevertheless, from then on, a decline in the tram road system started to take place. And at the same time, there was concerted effort among the motoring lobby, if you like, at that stage, to rid Dublin streets of the trams. And there would have been various letters at the time to the newspapers complaining about the problems that the trams were causing to the motorised traffic. Now, there were far more people using the trams than had motor cars at the time by a long shot. But nevertheless, the people who owned motor cars at that time were very vocal insofar as their demands were concerned. However, those demands for the trams to go didn't fall on deaf ears, because gradually line after line was dispensed with and reverted to motorised bus services. And indeed, it was in the early 1930s that the Dublin United Tramways Company had a name change. It became the Dublin United Transport Company, the emphasis being on the move towards motorised buses rather than electric trams. So when you move on into the 1940s and after the Second World War, in 1948, only 5 main services operated. Those services were the number 15 and the number 14, and those two tram lines went in the summer of 1948. And then when you move into 1949, what was left was Route 6, 7 and 8. And indeed, it was my experience as a young fella to have travelled on particularly the line to Dunleary, because my mother would bring me to visit her sisters in Dunleary. And of course, we'd always aim to go upstairs. But anyway, those three services ceased to exist from July 1949, and the very next day were replaced by buses. Up to 1959, the Hill of Howe tram operated, and not for another more than half a century would trams be seen on the roads in Dublin. In fact, it was the establishment of the new Lewis Green Line service and has proved highly successful and a very viable alternative to other road services. Not overlooking the great importance of the Dublin City bus service itself, run now by Dublin Bus. I think it was in the early 1960s that the first expressway service was operated by COE, and to my knowledge that service was in fact the Dublin to Cavan service, and it was seen as very innovative insofar as the provincial services were concerned, and it was the basis for quite an extensive network of expressway services, and that was apart from the ordinary provincial service provided by COE, was the basis of the network of services that we have today with Bus Éireann and its development of routes throughout the country in many respects. And I think serving probably every town and village at some stage throughout the country.
Bus driver Anne Burke represents the changing face of Dublin Bus. But how did it all come about?
I always wanted to drive a bus. Well, I'd never seen women bus drivers, so I never thought I could do it. So I went on and done other things. And then a girl in my class applied to become a bus conductor. And she got the job, and she told me there is a couple of women driving the buses. I was working in a hairdresser's at the time. I was there 16 years, and when I left, I just rang up one day and I said, I'm interested, I'd love to be a bus driver. And they sent me out the application form and just went from there. That was in 2003, and I'm here ever since. Love it.
What was it like the first time you drove a bus?
I felt at home. some people are nervous, and I actually felt at home. I used to say I have a little Yaris, and there was chunks out of that Yaris. Whereas the bus, not a bother. You're higher, it's automatic, you've bigger mirrors, and I always found them easy to drive. And I remember when we had open day for women, the women that we brought around the yard on the bus. Now, these went from driving a car, and we sat them in a bus. So now you're going to drive around the yard. They all said the same. It's a lot easier than they thought it was going to be. You know, your lane discipline, that's one thing you learn. Like when you're trained here, you carry that on then into a car. Like I see people in little cars and they're over in the bus lane. Whereas, you know, we have the lane discipline. But I've sat on buses as a passenger and I'm like, oh, you think you're going to hit something. And you're, but it's different when you're driving. Coming down through Phibsworth, because that's part of my route. And we've to get into that lane and you're going past a truck. And I know when people are sitting on saying, she's going to hit that truck. But I can see exactly how much I have to the centimetre. Do you know what I mean? I'm doing it. And I've often got a clap because like they do this. Oh, that was great. How did you do that? You got through that, you know. But it's different when you're driving. When you're behind the wheel, it's different.
Are there many women in Dublin Bus with similar roles on?
I couldn't believe that we didn't have more women in the beginning. Only 2% of CIE was women. Only 2%. They went all out. They pulled loads of us in. And they ask you, you know, why do you think we haven't got women working for us? Why are the women not applying? He said, right, we want to have open days just for women. And they did. Where just women came in the gate. You know, we put them behind the wheel and brought them around the yard. And we all spread the word as drivers. Do you want to be a driver? Why don't you go online? Half of them didn't think they could do it. Like, next thing, the women just came flowing in and it was great. That's the thing I noticed about Dublin buses. When they think there's something that they're not up there with, they sort it out and they get it done. And they did, and it's still ongoing.
We're taking the bus to Cork to meet Bus Éireann employee John Bone and to hear what it was like to work in Cork's main bus depot.
Well, I started working in Bus Éireann on the 1st of June 1980. I was 10 years in the railway first, and I went to Capwell to the road maintenance on promotion, actually. It was just one jump in promotion, so I spent the next 31 years there until I retired. I had been working in frontline positions in the railway, like in the booking office before I left, so it was a bit of a culture change for me to go into a very much a back office in the maintenance, where I was dealing with things like fuel accounts and fuel returns, mileage and all that sort of thing, and eventually purchasing, which is what I ended up doing mainly. The one advantage, I suppose, to me was going on a 9 to 5, Monday to Friday schedule, whereas in the booking office, I was working anything from 7 in the morning to 10 at night, 7 days a week, over shift work, you know, over 5 days, you know. So it was handy that way, you know, and we had a sort of normal lunch break and all that kind of thing. It was fairly typical office hours. When I started taking over purchasing, which basically I was a devolved buyer, which means that there's one principal buyer based in the stores in Broadstone, and then around the country there are devolved buyers, as we were called, in each garage, and each of them could purchase goods up to, in the end, it was only €500, so anything over that, you had to go through Broadstone again, through requisitions and that. But at the start, we used to phone up the companies quite a lot to phone in orders. Now, in the end, and that was computerised, so there was probably less phone work at that stage, you know. Like, again, it was all paper at the start, you know, and everything, like the fuel returns were paper. They were actually paper, and then they became computerised almost overnight, I understand. So definitely in purchasing, there was a big change, you know, and we had these books. They were like requisition books, really, but they were actually all purchase orders, and we'd write out what we wanted, and there were three parts of them, as far as I can remember. There was one went to the vendor, there was one went off with the accounts when they went to Dublin, like after they were certified, which I did as well. And then there was one for your own, for your advice notes as a copy to be kept on file, you know. And whereas in the end, then with the computerised system, it did away with all that, you know. We also then were buying everything, literally almost from a needle to an anchor type of thing. You know, we could have been buying parts for buses. No, when I say parts, they could be very small parts. Sometimes they could be nuts and bolts. There could be, sometimes you'd be buying maybe liner for the floor, you know, that kind of thing. We were virtually anything you would want in a bus, you know. Things like gearboxes and things like that too went through, but they went through Dublin. That was a different system. Like, we didn't actually, I wasn't involved in the purchasing of them much, you know. But and we also then were buying in services, like, for instance, especially towards the end. At the start, all our buses were, we all did virtually all the repairs ourselves, but with more computerisation of the diagnostics for buses, then in the end, the companies that we bought them from, like they say Volvo or Scania, one of these, it was the main dealer in Cork, would have to do a lot of that work. Then we'd have to send it out to them, and they'd have to, so we were raising orders for them as well, like, and some of those would be into the thousands, you know, so they, like, the order was issued in Dublin, but I did the paperwork or the computer work, as it was then, for them, you know. I was in the garage, and right in the centre of the garage in Capwell. I was in an office overlooking the garage. When I went to Capwell first, there was over 180 working in the maintenance alone, of which about between 35 and 40 were apprentices. When I left it, I think there was just over 80 there, you know, so over a period there was a huge reduction. That occurred by the fact that they took in less apprentices. They covered most of all the trades, really, that we had. We'd have had a mechanical mainly, and then we'd have had electrical, coach builders, trimmers, sheet metal workers. But in the end, it was only mechanical apprentices we had, you know.
John, were there any special perks in relation to working with CIE?
Well, one of the attractions, I suppose, of working in CIE at the time, when you remember that in the early 70s, airfares were almost like a second mortgage, was the fact that we had free travel on not only in Ireland and the UK, but we also had it in virtually all the countries of the continent. And I certainly availed of that almost every year that I was there. And I travelled with some work colleagues generally, because they were the only other people who had free travel. And I went all over the place. In 1972, I remember going to Venice. We did some great travelling, all right. We travelled around Spain, Portugal, Yugoslavia. I was in quite a lot in the old Yugoslavia, which I loved. And later on then, I got to know Bernard Byrne through a colleague of mine in Galway, Rosemary Keneally. She used to travel with Bernard and through the Connolly Travel Group. And I've been done sort of long-distance travels for quite a while with them. You know, I've been to South Africa, South America, and Australia and India. So, traveling is fabulous. And I really feel that the last couple, maybe nearly 2 years now, with the shutdown, is terrible, you know.
Indeed, the Connolly Station Travel Group was an ingenious idea that had far-reaching benefits for many CIE families. And hundreds of people from across CIE travelled every year with the group. The driving force behind it was the late Bobby White. His wife Agatha and their son Kieran bring us back to where it all began.
The first trip we went on, Mark Wilson was doing the travel agent. That was the Roman trip. And the following year, we started up the Connolly Station Holiday Group. 1976, we went overland to Killala. We had privileged tickets on the continent, which meant that we could go overland, which were quite cheap by comparison to flying or having to pay one's full fare. Because I do remember us all going, you know.
Yeah, there was 80 of us. And out of that 80, there was 9 whites. So we were, I suppose, the majority, were we?
As a family.
As a family, yeah. 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 We go down in the boat train. That time down to Dunleary, in the evening time, and got the ferry across to Holyhead. And then you got the sleeper down to London. We'd be in London at 6 or 7 in the morning, and we get another train then down to Dover, and then we get the ferry across from Dover to Tallaght, get the other train then halfway down to Europe, then I think you change over and got another one then. And remember, not enough couchettes that time.
Yeah.
And I remember my father doing a song and dance on the platform about it. And like, I think when they realised in the end that we were railway people, I think that kind of might have pulled a bit of a string for them to put on the extra one or whatever it was, you know. They got the extra coach put on. But I remember getting on that day and going to the coachettes and there was people in them.
Oh, yeah.
They were doubly booked. But, well, we got them in the end anyway.
You couldn't, a family of 7 wouldn't get to
Wouldn't get down the country.
Exactly.
Wouldn't get the Butlins.
Yeah, it would cost them more.
That's right. People were going to Butlins and we were going to Spain.
Yeah.
And to Rimini.
I mean, we were the
But of course, we were going for little or nothing because when you worked in CIE, you got the passes. I remember getting the night train there, going over the Alps and all that. And I remember in Rome and that, like, and going on the trips.
Yeah, I remember going on the trips myself. And it was amazing. Mainly, the groups were made of children. And you would have 40 Irish people moving across Europe. And it was quite incredible. But, my God, brilliant memories.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we good crack, like.
Yeah. The year that I went to Moscow, 78, Eileen had a friend that worked in the Irish embassy over there. And I met her. And she said, don't say anything in the house. If you want to talk, talk outside, because every place is bugged. From Moscow to Leningrad, we went by train. And we went to a circus in Leningrad and to an opera in Moscow. Il giorno poi del tuo
ritorno. Sei così sicura. Bobby White died suddenly in 1979. The loss of Bobby at such a young age was devastating for all, but especially for his wife Agatha and their 7 young children. But despite the new situation, Agatha continued on as treasurer of the group till relatively recently. Everybody who travelled on those trips owe Agatha and Bobby great thanks. A new green future is foremost in everyone's mind at the moment. Barry Kenny, Corporate Communications Manager at Éireann Róid Éireann and CIE, describes the impact of CIE's role in helping to protect our environment into the future.
Everybody talks about a new world in the morning. New world in the morning, so they say.
Sustainability and the environment is in the DNA of public transport. Public transport, by its nature, is a more sustainable option than the private car in terms of emissions per journey, in terms of the space it uses, in terms of noise pollution, everything like that. So we've always had a natural advantage in that regard. However, we're seeing, for example, on the rail side under DART Plus, we will treble the amount of lines that are electrified. So that will mean that almost 80% of journeys, when DART Plus is completed, which is the electrification to Drogheda, Maynooth, the M3 Parkway and Hazelhatch, will be powered by electricity. Likewise, in terms of moving to cleaner, greener technology on buses, that's going to be a huge trend over the coming years. And it means that if we look at the national plans for decarbonisation and climate action, and the goal to reduce emissions in the transport sector by 55% and ultimately get to net zero, public transport's absolutely going to be central to that. And the plans that we have will only accelerate it and help that last mile connection that people talk about by facilitating people with bikes to travel by public transport, by developing the facilities and services that are needed for that too. So it's a very exciting time. As we said, the policy impetus that's behind public transport has probably never been stronger, and that can only be a good thing for obviously for the companies, but also for the society and the environment as well. And I can feel the new tomorrow coming up. And I don't know why. Well, I suppose it's about increasing really the fleet. I think it's about continuing the investment program so that you do have a new and modern fleet and taking advantage of improvements in technology from a sustainability point of view. Like right now, and again, my apologies to my bus colleagues if my examples are rail biased, but in our fleet we have 629 carriages that can carry customers. We have a framework order out at the moment, tender process to order up to 750 new carriages over the next 10 years. So that gives you a scale. Now, that they won't all be extra. Ultimately, we're going to get to a point probably in the next, 5 to 10 years where the original Dart fleet, which is still operating since the first in-service Dart since 1984, so that 37 years now, that'll need to be replaced. It's still a very good fleet and reliable fleet, but we do need to get to a point where we don't lose that reliability. But it does show you that, albeit the cost of some of these trains can seem expensive, you get an incredible life out of them to think that, half the Dart fleet that's in operation today is the very same Dart fleet that was operating on day one in 1984. And we wouldn't think of driving a car around from 1984 by and large unless we were in the vintage market. But these are very reliable, very clean energy trains. I think it's fair to say, I mentioned, I suppose, the kind of understanding that exists today amongst policymakers of the importance of public transport. And, public transport and car, it's not necessarily either or. Everybody recognises that, for certain activities that, people will need the car. But I think the idea is to make public transport as attractive as possible for as many journeys as possible. And yes, it'd be a wonderful thing if we got to a situation where more and more people decided, well, actually, I don't need to have a car. The public transport network can assist me in 95% of my journeys. And I think as we develop things like Dart Plus, as we develop the Bus Connect network, as the Metrolink is developed by TII and new Lewis lines, that's going to become more and more practical consideration for people. Nothing ever stays still in public transport. That's, I suppose, where motion is our business. But it remains an exciting area to work in. And I think particularly the climate action requirements that everybody understands face us as a country, as a society and as a world. There's so much more that we can do and there's so much more that we are working to do at the moment. So we look forward to that. Now everybody talks about
we have come to the end of today's programme and all the programmes in the CAE 75 Years on the Go series, broadcast here on Near FM. We'd like to thank everyone who made this programme possible, and thank you for listening. A podcast of this programme and all the programmes in the series are available from the Near FM website. 75 Years on the Go is produced by Enda M. Roach and is a Perelman Media production for Near FM. Until next time, slán go fóill.